The Exchange Podcast is brought to you in part by your university system, including Granite State College, Keene State College, Plymouth State University, and the University of New Hampshire. Visit usnh.edu/yours to learn more.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Back in 1972, Congress passed a law called Title IX, aimed at reducing inequities in women's sports. Now, almost 50 years later, female athletics from town rec leagues up to the pros have definitely expanded, but the inequities are also still plain to see. For example, men's college coaches are paid far more than women's. At UNH, the men's head basketball coach makes three times as much as his female counterpart. And then there are the facilities. In March, at the NCAA tournament, a video of the men's and women's weight rooms went viral. The female teams were given basically a rack of dumbbells, while the men had a huge, gleaming workout facility. Today in The Exchange, why these stark differences still exist and why they're so hard to change. Exchange listeners, we welcome your questions. If you're a female athlete or coach, what have you noticed? If you're a fan, how do you engage with female athletes? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And our phone number is 800-892-6477. We're talking with Shira Springer. She's a columnist for the Sports Business Journal and a lecturer at Boston University. Shira, a big welcome. It's great to have you.
It's great to be here.
And also with us, Tori Amarello. She's executive director of Waterville Valley BBTS, a competitive snow sports club, and she's head of school at Waterville Valley Academy. And Tori, a big welcome to you too. Thanks for your time.
Thanks. I'm honored.
So Shira, what does the inequity look like between men's and women's sports, besides the dollar figures that are, you know, often cited?
Yeah, I mean, you also mentioned something like the practice facilities is a good example, you know, with the NCAA women's basketball tournament, the NCAA men's basketball tournament, but it's across the spectrum, even when you take money out of the equation. One thing that comes very quickly to mind in light of the fact that the Celtics have an open coaching position now is hiring practices, women getting hiring for high level positions in men's sports. And it was just last year that in Major League Baseball, you had the hiring of the first female general manager, Kim Eng, with the Miami Marlins. But she had been in the job market for 15 years. And a lot of people would say that she was overqualified by the time she got hired. It's aspects like practice times. You know, women's teams will get practice times that are not as favorable as the men's teams. So there are inequities across the whole spectrum of sports activities. And of course, I think you have to mention funding, though, and the money. It's not just the coaches' salaries, but it's the money invested in different sports. It's the television exposure. It's widely cited that women's sports receive only 4% of media coverage in the United States. So there are lots of both inequities and inequalities baked into the system.
Well, and Shira, I have to ask you, because I was just looking again at the NCAA story that came out in March. Again, the women had basically, can I call it a closet? I mean, it was this pretty shabby little room. And then the men's place was like, oh my gosh, who wouldn't want to work out there? It was just enormous and shiny and new. And were you surprised by those photos when they went viral, Shira?
Not surprised at all. And I think, you know, that's part of the problem, which is we all know these inequalities and inequities exist in the women's sports world. And we also know the pattern that this follows, right? So when this news came out, when the videos came out and the photographs came out, it was all over social media. The NCAA was saying, well, there wasn't enough space. So then, of course, the athletes took pictures of all the space where they could have put this weight room facility. And then, of course, the next natural progression was a bunch of private companies said, well, hey, we can give you the equipment that you need. And the NCAA saying, well, this was an oversight, so on and so forth. No, somebody didn't pay attention. Somebody didn't care enough about the women's tournament to give them the proper facilities to train throughout every round of the tournament. And that both what happened and what happened afterwards in terms of the excuses the NCAA made are very predictable at this point.
Yeah, there's one thing to make a mistake. There's another one to kind of go, well, you know, just say, exactly. Yeah, mistake. We're going to fix it. End of story.
And not only, well, mistake, we're going to fix it, but we need to do a real long look at how we're organizing this tournament, who's in charge, who is responsible for this, and really get into sort of the systematic or the systemic issues, rather, that are at fault here, and the whole structure of the organization of, you know, the NCAA that is prioritizing the men's basketball tournament and sort of pushing the women's basketball tournament off to the side, or at least deprioritizing. Now, you know, part of this is revenue, and the men's tournament is the big money maker for the NCAA. But you also have to bring into the conversation the fact that the women's tournament really hasn't been given a proper opportunity to make that kind of money. It doesn't have the same level of exposure. And so you have to separate that from, okay, well, now the men's tournament is the big money maker, but it has a tremendous head start and some other advantages that make it that big money maker. Let's see what happens if you invest in the women's tournament.
Well, we would definitely talk about the systemic issues this hour, but Tori, I'm curious, like, what are the inequities look like from your end? I mean, you're involved in snow sports, where it seems to me there is a fair bit of equity and attention among male and female athletes.
Yeah, I think the advantages of being in snow sports, right, ski racing and freestyle and free skiing and snowboarding, is that boys and girls at the youth ages really compete together, right? The teams are all co-ed. The kids have the experience of being out in the cold and the wind and the rain, because we live in New Hampshire, together. And I think that's pretty empowering. I know, as a former ski racer myself, one of the beautiful things about my experience growing up in the sport was that I had boys as teammates. And I really felt like my ability to not be cowed by boys and by men was came a lot from that co-ed sport experience. Obviously, that's unique and not going to happen in a lot of traditional team sport environments, but I do think there's some of that relationship building and some of that mutual respect is super powerful when you look at the experience that our kids, my kids in my organization, have in this sport.
I want to touch on, Tori, what Shira just said. The explanation for the disparities that Shira described are often this, you know, men's sports bring in, as Shira said, lots of viewers, lots of money. So any institution, whether it's a college or a professional league, is just going to look at those numbers and say, look, it's a return on investment. I want to ask both of you what you think about that. But Tori, you go ahead. You first, please.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, I don't have the statistics that bear this out at hand, but I think there's been some demonstrated opportunities where women's sports have received a lot of media attention. You know, thinking about the Women's World Cup, 50% of children in America are female, right? And a lot of little girls play sports. And when we are given the opportunity to put media representation in front of our daughters, in front of our female athletes, it's just so powerful. And then, you know, when you go looking for more of that media representation, it can be really difficult to find. So I do think there's starting to be some demonstrated experiences where, when there is media investment, there is a response, right? I bought an Alex Morgan jersey for my daughter following the Women's World Cup. And I think that, you know, she had no idea who that player was before the Women's World Cup was accessible to her on television. So I do think we can see corollaries there, causalities, connections, but you know, it's really hard when the men's sports dominate the airwaves to such a massive extent. There really isn't a reason for media to make a change.
Go ahead, Shira. I know you've written about this, sort of the argument that, hey, men's sports bring in the cash and this is a business. But it's kind of like the dog chasing its own tail, so to speak. So go ahead, Shira.
Yeah, I mean, and as I mentioned earlier, that head start helps, right? So you've built up that audience over decades for men's sports, and women haven't had that same opportunity, in part because they haven't had the decades, and in part because they just simply haven't been given the media exposure of late. It always defaults to the men. And I think the other problem is that even when the women are doing better or are trending upward, that doesn't always get one recognized or rewarded. And I think one of the interesting things to come out of the 2021 men's NCAA tournament, let's stick with basketball and college basketball here, is that the men's championship game on CBS was down 14%. This is over 2019, because they didn't have a tournament in 2020, in the ratings. It averaged now 16.9 million viewers, so still a large audience, but it was the smallest CBS title game audience since 1982. Meanwhile, ESPN said that viewership for the women's championship game averaged 4.1 million and peaked at 5.9 million, making it the most watched final since 2014. And I know there's a disparity in numbers, but what I would hope that people would focus on is the trend, the upward trend for women. There's excitement around women's sports. There's opportunity around women's sports. And it would seem that even just looking at the women's sports, that small sampling, if you promote the women's sports, if you give them an opportunity to be on nationally, you know, broadcast national networks, whether they're cable networks or something like CBS, you might be surprised at how many, what the ratings will be and how many audience members and new fans you draw in. And I think there's another important component to this discussion too, which is women's sports aren't necessarily consumed the same way that men's sports are consumed. It's been shown through data that statistically, there's a larger presence on social media for women's sports and more social engagement. And I think we have to think about that in terms of social value, in terms of monetary value. So we also have to rethink what it means to be a viewer or to be engaged with women's sports and find figure out a way to put that in monetary terms so that it's sort of an apples to apples comparison with the men's sports.
Oh, that's interesting, Shira. So I hadn't thought about that. So it's the idea that don't just gauge the success, air quotes there, of women's sports on traditional metrics like viewers and cash, look more broadly?
Exactly. So one of the examples that comes up, I believe it was the Elite Eight in the NCAA tournament, was that the UConn versus Baylor game was much hyped and it was a real showdown. And I think they had twice as many social media engagements as the men's game, you know, at the same time or the same round of competition. And there's a company, Zoomf, that calculated the social value of that. And it was a, you know, a nearly $700,000 social value. And so I think women get stuck by being against the metrics, you know, by being measured with the metrics that have always worked for the men and quite frankly, keep the men ahead. And now that we're in a much more digital world, a much more social media oriented world, and that's where a lot of the fan base for women's sports grew up, you're gonna have to start looking at that and the value of that. And sponsors should look at that. Sports executives should look at the value of that. Broadcasters should look at the value of that and make adjustments, because the opportunity, if you look at those numbers, the opportunity, that upward trend, in my mind, is with the women.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole big territory to capitalize on.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us as we talk about women's sports today and the inequities that remain almost 50 years after Title IX. Let's hear from you, Exchange listeners. What have you witnessed as an athlete or a coach or a fan? Let us know by email to exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook or give us a call, 800-892-6477. So, Tori and Shira, I want to read a couple emails. Alina writes, I want to discuss women's soccer because as a young female athlete, I find some inequities very discouraging. One of them is the professional soccer equal pay case between the men's and women's teams. This was addressed by the United States women's national team, but they were not granted equal pay after the case closed. I don't want other girls to be stuck with the idea that men's sports are superior, because they really aren't, says Alina. It's discouraging to put all of this effort in when there still remains a pay and equity gap. The women's national soccer team keeps winning all these medals in the Olympics when the men's team rarely even qualifies. Thank you, Alina, for writing. Here's one from Katie. Katie says, Sport New Zealand commissioned a media analysis company to study coverage of sports in New Zealand. The numbers are startling. 83% of coverage was of men's sports versus 15% of women. Female athletes were three times more likely to receive comments on their appearance versus men, and 82% of fans quoted are male. It's no wonder women are paid less if they can't get equal coverage. And Katie, thank you for writing. And both of you, Tori, you first, how do you see female athletes being covered, and how does that sort of perpetuate what we're talking about?
Yeah, I think I'm going to go back to something Shira was talking about earlier, which is the social media engagement with female, you know, sheroes, female athletes. I think that makes the relationship with fans feel really personal. You know, in my experience and my professional experience, I think female athletes feel less packaged. And I think there's something really appealing about that for fans. And I think that's pretty powerful. It also has been really interesting to see, you know, the sort of this new generation of female athletes respond to that and sort of take control of their narrative in really interesting ways. Obviously, there's been a recent example with Naomi Osaka, sort of taking the reins on her relationship with the press in, you know, a really empowered way. I don't think it necessarily has been smooth for her, but I think female athletes are recognizing that a lot of their power, especially the high profile ones, comes from the fact that they can engage directly with fans. And I think the fact that we as fans have been willing to do that is a really positive feedback loop on how female athletes are communicating and how they're connecting with new and future fans.
So sort of relating to what Shira said earlier, don't just look at, you know, the old metrics mm-hmm. of money that comes in from commercials for these major sporting events or the number of eyeballs that you guests are watching. Look at it more broadly. I do want to talk about Naomi Osaka. And for people who don't know, she's a tennis champion. She withdrew from the French Open recently because the media coverage was just so intense and stressful. And after this happened, the Washington Post wrote about the disparities in how female athletes are covered, saying male athletes get to be athletes, women get pestered, and it dug into the personal, even Shira, sometimes creepy questions that female athletes get asked by reporters. One, a very famous tennis player got asked by a reporter to give us a twirl to show off your outfit. I mean, can you imagine a man being asked, like, give us a twirl? What about the coverage, Shira? The Washington Post said sometimes it veers on creepy.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. And it's sort of become, these press conferences have become a necessary evil. You've got a lot of media, particularly the Grand Slam tournaments, who want to talk to the top tennis players in the world, and they obviously can't do that, you know, talk to them all one on one. So this is a major issue, and I think in light of what Naomi Osaka has done, it will be revisited, this access. But I think one of the interesting things to happen in the wake of all that Naomi Osaka says was they started playing clips of women at the podium in these press conferences with the questions they were asked, but it wasn't so much the questions. I mean, it was that, but it was also their reaction. And you could tell they were being pestered and having to go over parts of either their personal life or a match they just lost over and over again. And you could see in the female players, this was Serena Williams at one point, a video that I saw, Jennifer Capriati, an old video that I saw, the rising level of frustration. At one point, there was Serena in a press conference asking a reporter to apologize for a question that she thought was inappropriate. There was Jennifer Capriati breaking down in tears because she said, listen, I've answered this. I don't want to keep talking about it. But the reporter persisted with the question. So I think it is different for female athletes. They do get more personal and they sort of nitpick or chip away or try to chip away sometimes, maybe intentionally, maybe not intentionally, at the confidence of these female athletes with questions, at least in the sampling that I saw, that just seemed to go over the same territory over and over again. But generally speaking, I think it's very difficult to have just played a match, to come into a press conference, particularly if you lose, and then have, you know, a group of journalists basically dissect everything you did wrong. And Naomi Osaka was taking a mental health stand. And I can't imagine any scenario, no matter what the question is, where going through your most recent failure, essentially, is good for your mental health.
they do that, reporters do that. I'm not a sports reporter, obviously, but they do that with male athletes too, don't they, Shira? Are you saying it's different for female athletes?
They do it for male athletes and female athletes. It's not different. I'm saying that the whole system needs to be revised in general and rethought. Women, I think, get the worst of it. They get more intrusive questions, and they often get more personal questions and questions that aren't related to their tennis necessarily. You talk about the twirl. That's a very good example, or the request for a twirl. So the women get the worst of it, but I think the whole system in that case, it's a case where the whole system is broken or at least needs to be revisited.
Shira, right. I would also yeah, say ahead, that sorry. The response to, women and men respond to those sort of stimulus in different ways, right? And so the difference between like being seen as too emotional or being seen as fragile versus being passionate, right? John Harbaugh can throw chairs and smash clipboards and get right in refs' faces. But if a female coach does that, she's losing her cool. And I think when female athletes do that, it's harder for them to come back from bursting into tears at a press conference. And I think that's something that we as female athletes are sort of, we try really hard to control our emotions in that way. And I think that's, it's especially hard when that, you know, that's not how you're supposed to respond, but you can't help but respond that way because you're being sort of backed into this corner in a super, super, super public way. So I think the way that female and male athletes are allowed to respond to frustrations and stressful situations is really problematic.
Completely right. Agree. Wow. And I would say that men are in some ways encouraged to show that passion, that hyper competitiveness, that anger. It's almost seen as a positive trait that, you know, you will let nothing stop you. Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunate.
Coming up, so we've talked about the problem. Coming up, we are going to hear about young female athletes who are working to change the conversation. We'll speak with a D1 collegiate athlete from New Hampshire about her experiences playing at the college level. And we'll keep taking your emails at exchange@nhpr.org and your phone calls at 800-892-6477. Stay with us.
I've been listening to NHPR for about as long as I can remember.
New Hampshire Public Radio went on the air on the date of our son's first birthday.
I've only been here for about 4 months. NHPR has just helped me get more perspective on the state that is now my home.
Whether you've been listening for just a few weeks or you've been a loyal listener for decades, NHPR is your public radio station. Actively support your connection to community-minded journalism by becoming a member at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, inequity in women's sports. From lower coach salaries to shabby weight rooms to minuscule press coverage, we're asking why this issue persists and who's pushing for change. What have you observed as an athlete yourself, as a coach, a fan, or a parent of a daughter who plays sports? And how do you think this pervasive problem should be addressed? Let us know by email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or you can give us a call at 800-892-6477. We're talking with Shira Springer. She's a columnist for the Sports Business Journal and a lecturer at Boston University. Also with us, Tori Amarello. She's head of school at Waterville Valley Academy. And joining us now is Stephanie Davis. She's a freshman at College of the Holy Cross, where she's a member of the women's basketball team. She's from Windham, New Hampshire. Welcome, Stephanie. Great to have you in The Exchange.
Hi, good to be here.
What disparities have you noticed as a college athlete, Stephanie, and congratulations on that, between the men's and women's teams?
So there's been a lot of disparities in funding, practice times, equipment. We see this on like a national scale, for example, the NCAA tournament, but also on a smaller scale as well.
What do you see at your school?
Specifically, I mean, with classes, the men were allowed to take classes this summer while the women weren't. We had to pay for classes. But obviously, when we spoke up about it, the situation was handled and we were able to take classes this summer. I think like small things like that. Practice times. I mean, it's hard, really getting the same practice times and managing it with the men's team and equipment. They have more equipment. They'll get equipment. We don't. And it happens all the time. Yeah.
But I obviously heard, like those yeah, go ahead.
Things and they become, I mean, we bring them up and they're settled. They have been at least for the most part this year, which is great.
You mentioned paying for classes. And from what I understand, Stephanie, correct me if I'm wrong, there was an issue of summer classes. The men's basketball team members did not have to pay. The women initially were told they had to pay $2,000 a class.
Yes.
And you guys said, uh-uh. And was that changed?
Yes, it was. Yep, immediately.
Yeah. Have you been surprised by some of this stuff, Stephanie, given that you played basketball in high school? Again, you're just a freshman, so you're coming right out of high school.
It's not super surprising because the trends obviously begin in high school. I think like we see bigger fan sections at the men's games, more promoting at men's games. And I think this just follows up into college. Obviously, the women's game has progressed immensely, so I think we now see more fans at the women's games, but it's pretty much continued.
How do your coaches, Stephanie, talk about some of these disparities?
So I know my coaches always have my back, and obviously the best interests of my teammates and me, and they're always trying to do right by us. By having conversations with the right people and always being willing to hear us out and have creative solutions to issues that do arise. It's definitely something that comes up.
Are most of your coaches female, Stephanie?
Yeah, I have 3 female coaches and then 1 male coach.
Okay. Hang on, Stephanie, for a minute. I want to bring our other guests in, Tori and Shira. And Tori, how important is it to have female coaches for a women's team? Does it matter?
Oh my gosh, it matters so much. And I mean, it's just one of those things that if a female athlete doesn't see professional pathways in her sport, I think it limits the way that they think about their participation in the sport. I mean, we know that very few children are going to go on to be professional athletes, but being a professional athlete on the field is a small slice of the way that you can be a sport professional. I mean, Shira and I are both making a living as sport professionals, and you know, we're not athletes, but we're making a living in sports. And I think that that's one of the ways that we limit how girls think about themselves as athletes, is because they don't see professional women in sports to the extent that they see men as professionals in sport. You know, there have been positive changes, like, you know, there are women coaching in the NFL, there are women coaching in Major League Baseball. But those are such infinitesimal percentages of the overall professional coaching ranks. And, you know, there are female sports reporters, there are female executives, but again, there's not equity in those roles. And I think thinking about your sport as your sort of lifelong pursuit is, it opens up a whole new avenue for young girls in really healthy ways, that this doesn't just have to be something that you stop doing when you get to middle school or you stop doing when you get to high school, right? You see almost 50% of girls drop out between those ages. And so this can be something that you continue doing because you can think of yourself as getting a job connected to your sports. So I think female coaching in that way is really important in giving girls vision. I also think female coaching is just super, super powerful because the experience is different. You connect with female athletes in a different way. Female coaches bring something to the table that male coaches just don't. Just they're different. It's okay. Male coaches certainly have a role as well, but the limited number of female coaches in all of sport is a challenge for female athletes.
Shira, I'd love your thoughts too about the role of the coach, male or female, in pointing out some of the inequities that Stephanie mentions and that we've talked about. You know, lots of politics at colleges and lots of scrabbling over dollars, I'm sure. So what is the coach's role in saying, hey, my female athletes can't pay $2,000 a class when the guys don't have to?
Yeah, no, first of all, I want to say I completely agree with Tori, as someone who competed in track and field and cross country in college and did not have a female coach. I often wonder what it would have been like if I had had that female role model there, and also someone sort of fighting for the women on the team. And that gets to your question, which is, you know, it's crucial to have women at every level fighting for female athletes at the coaching level, at the administrative level, because they will be perhaps, and one would hope, more attuned to the issue that female athletes face and can ensure that the system isn't working against the female athletes at the school. And I was thinking about sort of some of the inequities you also hear. You know, you talked about practice times and the paying of summer classes. I've talked to college coaches, and one of their big frustrations is they'll say, well, you know, our system, like if they're at a hockey school, quote unquote, quote unquote hockey school, they'll say, well, you know, the men's hockey team is seen as the big draw and, you know, it makes all the money and they have lots of ticket sales. But then they'll say, but they're not promoting our sport. They're not selling tickets to our game. So how can we even begin to compete from a revenue standpoint with the men's team? What would happen if they promoted our sport more? Maybe things would be different. I heard from a coach, I believe she was from Duluth, Minnesota, who was talking about how they didn't have a concession stand and at their, you know, during their games. And it seems like such a small thing. Well, you don't have a, but that's a moneymaker, you know.
Oh,
they had
absolutely.
Parents bringing in, you know, carafes of coffee and baking brownies to sell at games. It shouldn't be that way for female athletes, for women's teams at the college level. So, I mean, there are so many little layers and little issues that come up. And I think you have to have women at every level, again, who might be more attuned to those smaller issues that might not be apparent in a statistic or might not be, you know, sort of flash, you know, easy to perceive. And I think that's, hopefully we'll have more women athletic directors, more women sports commissioners in college who will say, this isn't the way this is gonna be. I mean, that's what happened, you know, in the wake of the NCAA weight room controversy or scandal, whatever you wanna call it. Women, female ADs and female sports commissioners said, you know, were among the loudest voices saying, this has got to change and this has got to change quickly.
Again, Exchange listeners, join us as we talk about ongoing inequities in women's sports 50 years after Title IX was passed to try to address some of these. How do you view this complex issue and how do you think it should be addressed as a coach yourself or a female athlete? Or a fan or a parent of a female athlete. We'd love to hear from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And our phone number is 800-892-6477. You know, Stephanie, before you joined us, we talked a lot about, you know, inequities in facilities and definitely in funding in terms of coach salaries and promotions and so forth. You mentioned practice times, though, Stephanie. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? What kind of practice times you guys get versus the men?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just hard figuring out scheduling and all that kind of stuff. So a lot of our practices were tended to be later this year. It's just how it worked out, whether it was coaching or and whatnot. But I think that was one of the issues that arose just talking to some people, but
go ahead, Stephanie. Sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I'm just wondering, like, are you getting practice time at, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning or 10 o'clock at night or being, you know, yeah, go ahead.
Really late or really early. And I'm not sure exactly if it's issues with, you know, whatever. I don't know who gets choices first or whatnot and whatnot, but I know that our practice times were a little bit crazy this year.
Stephanie, I also wanted to ask you about role models. Shira and Tori talked about, you know, having role models not only out on the court, but in coaching, in the media, in sports management. Who are your role models, Stephanie? You know, either at your school or just in pro sports?
Well, I think my mom is one of my biggest role models. She's definitely taught me to be strong, confident. Another really huge role model is Kim Benson. She graduated from Holy Cross and played basketball here. She coached AAU for me. Karen Clough, she was my advisor at Proctor Academy, and she has really helped me to develop good social skills and really, you know, be able to communicate and get my point across when I talk. And yeah, she's been great.
Well, and last question for you, Stephanie, you know, again, to this idea of role models and women in sports everywhere, not just on the field or on the court. How are you and your teammates sort of viewing your future and, you know, your future involvement in sports once you graduate, whether as players or managers or marketers or whatever?
I want to coach when I'm older, because I think it's really important that women have those voices. As we were talking about, like, right now, there's only 12% of athletic directors that are women in Division I. So I think we need more women applying for positions like this, as well as coaching positions and other important positions of power. I think over the next, like, 5 to 10 years, we should see a lot of change, because there has been change in the last 5 to 10 years. So I think this trend will continue. Obviously, big immediate change, like the NCAA tournament, like things like that, like where the weights were different for the women than the men. We'll see big change like that, but some things are obviously going to take more time. And yeah, I think my teammates and I know that, and we have to be part of that process in taking big roles in our communities, as well as on and off the court too.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. You know, the position of athletic director at a high school or a college, that's a big job. And it sounds like a small percentage of that right now is taken up by women. Well, Stephanie, no matter what path you choose, good luck to you. And thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Stephanie Davis. She's a freshman at College of the Holy Cross, where she's a member of the women's basketball team. She is from Windham, New Hampshire. And Tori and Shira, lots of emails coming in now. I'd love to share a couple with you. Here's one listener, didn't give a name. Inequality in spending and treatment of girls' teams is rampant at the high school level as well. At Plymouth Regional High School, the field hockey team must play on the baseball field. Wow, that sounds difficult. The football field is strictly off limits to everyone except the football team. And spending on the football team is much higher than any other sport. Thank you to that person for writing. Here's another email about football. Ingrid says, an equity and budgeting issue that has bothered me for years is the cost of lighting for night football games as part of school budgets, especially here in New Hampshire, where tax dollars are paying for that item on the budget. Girls' sports don't have that expense in the school budgets. I've often wondered what a difference in the budget would be made by having Saturday afternoon football games rather than on Friday night. That expense hides in the utilities or facilities part of the budget and somehow can't be separated out when the question is asked. So we could do a whole show on football and, you know, sort of some of the issues around the costs. We won't go there now, but what about at the high school level in general, Tori? Sort of how much has Title IX kind of made a difference in terms of girls and boys athletics at the high school and college level?
Yeah, so I think the legislation has only helped. I mean, there's been, there's countless studies about how the rapid expansion of the number of female athletes happened right after Title IX and has only continued. So we see a phenomenal number of girls start in sport. We see a dramatic decrease in the number of female athletes between 8th and 10th grade, which is when, body image issues and self-perception and sort of the social pressures of high school really start to kind of get in girls' way. And so as sport leaders, that's something where we spend a lot of time thinking about is retention in our sports. It does not have an easy answer because there are so many societal pressures on young girls that sport is just one element. But I do think that you know, we have lots of evidence that the girls who stick to sports, whether, you know, they're high level competitors or recreational competitors, like the girls who stick to sport, there's enormous increases in self-esteem. There's enormous increases in their self-worth, their value, their self-value. And then you see the long-term outcomes of that, that there's some outrageous statistic, like 94% of C-suite level females were athletes as young girls. And so I think—
Really?
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty unbelievable just the value that sports have for young females. Like I said, whether they, you know, identify as athletes throughout their lives or whether they just have that in their back pocket. So I think that's powerful. I also think there's been some interesting conversations about the way that we organize our sports. And this is, it's a little bit of a pivot, but there's an interesting thing that happened recently where the German national team, the German national gymnastics team came out for a competition in full body suits. So long sleeves and long pants, rather than the leotards that we're accustomed to seeing on high level gymnasts. And that was the athlete's choice. I think that's one of those ways that we see athletes starting to sort of take ownership of the narrative, take ownership of their participation, that they are not comfortable wearing skimpy leotards. And seeing, like, I'm so fascinated by how that will play out on a 12-year-old gymnast's identity as a gymnast, because I do think there's some leadership happening with female athletes that's going to trickle down and be really interesting.
Oh, that is really interesting. And I had not heard that. So instead of wearing those, you know, little teeny leotards that female gymnasts typically wear, Tori, they came out in long sleeves and long legs, fully covered legs.
Yeah. And I guess I don't know the name of the German gymnastics organization, but they gave the athletes the choice. And the athletes, every female athlete on that team chose the long sleeves and long pants, which is, it's now allowed, which was one of the questions, is that even going to be allowed, right? Because the sport dictates what the uniforms are for the sport. You're not allowed to show up for a competition and just whatever you feel like.
Right.
But when they were given the choice, that's how they felt more comfortable competing. And I think that's athletes taking the lead on some of these conversations, which I, you know, obviously agree with everything that's been said about how change takes time, but I maybe it's my internal optimism, but I do feel like there's been an acceleration in some of those, which I do connect directly to that social media influence, that there's now so much more voice available to female athletes, despite traditional media not giving them the airwaves.
Related to what you said, here's an email from Sam who says, my daughters have been part of gymnastics, volleyball, and tennis. The required uniforms for these are basically a bathing suit, booty shorts, and a mini skirt, respectively. Sam says, I find it absolutely ridiculous that men can wear regular shorts for all three of these sports. Sam, thank you so much for writing. And we have to take a very quick station break. But when we come back, keep those emails coming in. We love hearing from you. Our address is exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook if you'd like, or give us a phone call, 800-892-6477.
A few things have changed since NHPR first began as Granite State Public Radio just about 40 years ago.
Tonight we welcome WEVO in Concord, New Hampshire to the NPR and All Things Considered family.
But through it all, local listener support has made this station possible. And for a limited time, we'll send you our latest enamel camp mug featuring the retro Granite State Public Radio logo when you become a sustainer at the discounted rate of $5 a month. Give today at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Catch up on all the state news of the week that you might have missed. Join us for the Roundup with host Peter Biello, Friday morning, live at 9. Today, recent reminders that inequities in women's sports continue, from coach salaries at colleges to workout facilities to how female athletes are covered by the media. Exchange listeners, it's been good to hear from you. Let us know how you think this complex issue plays out here in our state, and how you think it should be addressed. from your viewpoint as a coach or a parent or a fan or a female athlete yourself. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our number, 800-892-6477. So, Cher, I'd love for you to sort of follow up on what Tori said before the break. You know, yes, it's slow. Yes, there are still things like, you know, give us a twirl so we can see your new tennis outfit. But what progress do you see? And what makes you feel sort of hopeful?
I'm going to piggyback off of what Tori said with regard to what makes me feel hopeful is social media. And I know that sounds strange, but I do think it is a way for athletes, both male and female, to get their voices out there directly to their fans, directly to the public. And for female athletes who don't have a large amount of media coverage, who don't get a lot of national broadcast windows, it's incredibly valuable to have that direct channel to fans. And I think one good example of that is what happened with Naomi Osaka. Now, initially, the directors of the Grand Slam tournaments were sort of like, no, this is unacceptable. And they took a fairly hard stance. But then when Naomi Osaka explained herself more through social media, talked about her anxiety at press conferences, talked about her depression, and then got social media support from really high profile athletes and high profile figures, again, through those social media channels, the Grand Slam tournament directors were like, oh, okay, this is something we have to examine, and we have to examine it sooner rather than later. And basically what that social media is doing is it's providing a way for people and leaders, quite frankly, male leaders who are sort of stuck with the tradition and kind of only go in the traditional ways or only see traditional ways to govern a sport. It's forcing them increasingly to, one, see other ways, and two, see that there is the public opinion is shifting, and what they think is right may not be what fans of tennis and other athletes think is right. So that gives me hope for the future. And I think just in general, awareness of what's happening is a benefit. And the more we talk about it, the more there are shows like this where we talk about the inequities. It reminds people, it tells people that, hey, action has to be taken. And I know we talked, and I talked about the Celtics coach, the opening with for the Celtics head coach at the very top of the show. The NBA is doing some really interesting stuff. You know, they have now, or at least they started the season with 11 female assistant coaches. But of the 10 NBA coaching hires made during the offseason, there were no female head coaches. So they're still awaiting that first female head coach. But in an attempt to make things more equitable, they've created a database where people in positions of power who are doing the hiring can more easily compare the qualifications of all the coaches and start to see, hey, some of these female assistants are really qualified and deserving of a really good look for a head coaching position. So I think it's also about that, making the qualifications, whether it's for a coaching job or an AD job or a commissioner job, more readily apparent, changing the system, and quite simply just seeing the value in women's sports and giving it more exposure.
Got an email from Mary. Speaking of coaching, she says, I am a coach for a co-ed track and field team at the high school. I am thrilled to see the changes that have slowly been occurring, but this is a problem that permeates even the lowest levels of women's sports. The coaching environment at the high school level is still very much a boys' club. Female coaches are often not provided with the same equipment of male coaches. Mary says, for example, there are no women's sizes in coaching polos. And I think that means like the polo shirt that coaches wear. She says, I know from my own experience that having a female coach can be highly empowering as a female athlete, but the coaching environment needs to change in order to promote coaching at all levels. And Mary, thank you for writing. Cher, I also want your quick thoughts on something again that Tori told us earlier, that a lot of girls drop out of sports once they hit high school. Now, again, we've done entire shows on that, so we don't need to go into it too far, but where is the discouragement for young female athletes coming from?
Oh, gosh, I don't think you can pinpoint one area, but I think part of it is, you know, we talked about earlier, it's sort of not having those role models of what a future in sports can look like. So if you're not having female coaches, or if you're not seeing female pro athletes, not that every young female athlete will become a pro player, but if you don't have those role models out there, if you don't see a future that includes you, that can be problematic. I think it can also be exhausting. If you are, let's say, playing on your high school soccer team and you see more attention, more resources, more money, better practice times, better practice fields being given to the boys' teams, and you're saying, well, why isn't that for me? Yeah, why bother? And why don't I get that? And maybe if they're not investing in me, why am I going to invest my time and my energy and my resources there? And then I think it's also just encouragement and some cultural stuff where young men, boys, are encouraged to be involved in sports more than young women. Now, all of this is changing, but there are still, I think, vestiges of that attitude where, hey, if you're a young girl, maybe your energies would be better placed elsewhere. And they don't get as encouraged to continue in their sports careers. Particularly, I would think, you know, the star athletes are one thing, but it's that group of female athletes that do it just because they enjoy the competition, they enjoy the camaraderie, they enjoy playing on a team, they enjoy the challenge that athletics provide. And I think that group may sort of get not ignored, but kind of not as much attention and not as much encouragement as they might need to continue through their high school years. And, you know, maybe there needs to be a wider range of options for female athletes too. In some cases, I know there are high schools where boys have more options of what they can play as opposed to the girls' teams.
Is that legal under Title IX though, Shira?
It's complicated. So I was going to say, and as with all things with gender, I don't know if legal, not legal is the word to put on it. It's not that they, you know, it's like, oh, well, you can play on a boys team if you want to participate in this sport. So let's say, you know, hypothetically, and this has been done, I'm really interested in football and, you know, I want to play on a football team. Well, you can play on the boys team, but is that really the best environment? This is, I was going to say, a whole other category of conversation about what should be provided at the high school level for male and female athletes and the support they should get. I mean, it can be, you know, there are other issues too that are much smaller than what teams, but, you know, talk about no polo sized shirts for female coaches. Well, there's also issues with just new uniforms. I've heard, you know, high school athletes talk about how the boys football team or the boys soccer team gets new uniforms every 2 or 3 years and the girls teams don't. So there are inequities like that.
So here's another question. And Tori, I'll turn to you first as we close out. What about the fans, whether at the pro level or the college level, or the high school level? You know, what's their role in all this?
We have to spend our money. I think that's part of it. I mean, I think demonstrating support for professional, then this is more at the professional level, but yeah, I mean, you comment about the booster clubs and the concessions, even at high school sports, like it matters, showing up matters, voting with your feet matters, voting with your dollars matters. But I also think there's a role for professional fans, right? There's been some really sort of like heartwarming photos coming out of male NBA players walking into the stadium wearing WNBA sweatshirts or WNBA jerseys, or, you know, tweeting or posting on Instagram about their, you know, favorite WNBA players. And I think that sort of visibility, that sort of allyship is powerful. There, you know, LeBron James has a platform that Sabrina Ionescu does not. And so I think that when he, you know, tweets or posts about her, that's a powerful show of fandom that carries a lot of weight. So I think for, you know, regular people, fans like me, buying the jersey, following on social media, engaging on social media matters a lot, you know, posting comments and following like that support, I have to imagine for professional athletes really matters. Those are things that people in positions of power pay attention to. But in general, I think being a female athlete can be pretty lonely. And so the more visible support is, I think the more helpful it will be. So I think, speaking on a personal level, like I feel personally invested in making sure that the National Women's Soccer League succeeds. Like I feel responsible for that in a way that I would never feel responsible for the success of the NBA, right? I feel like I can make a difference there. And some of that has to do with a smaller scale, but I think being a fan is something where you can actually have a voice in women's sports.
Okay, so Shira, real quick, what about the fans?
Yeah, I think Tori's absolutely right. And I think, you know, she spoke about the WNBA players. There was a Bruins player who was wearing a hat from the local women's Boston pro team, the Pride. And I think that's where we have to look, that allyship. But I also want to shift from the fans. Media has to do its part too in publicizing and giving exposure, because it's a two-way street. The fans have to sort of vote with their feet and show up, but the media also has to make them aware and tell the stories of these female athletes so they can get engaged and get involved with women's sports.
All right. Well, it's been great to talk to both of you. And Shira, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Shira Springer. She's a columnist for the Sports Business Journal and a lecturer at Boston University. And Tori, good to meet you too. Thank you for your time.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
That's Tori Amorello, executive director of Waterville Valley BBTS, a competitive snow sports club, and head of school at Waterville Valley Academy. Today's show was produced by Exchange producer Jane Vaughn. Thanks, everybody, for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.